I could outpace people if I needed to. I know how to do that, and I've been in that spot. I've seen a lot of people succeed in business because they're really good at what they do. As you're doing your business, like, remember why you got into this.
Are there any elements of your upbringing or early experience that you felt shaped your career in business or interest in economic development?
It's funny, I was on a podcast last night, a similar question came up, and so I got to unpack a little bit of that. So my dad was a first generation immigrant from Mexico here. I mean, he came over when he was 8, but he grew up heavily influenced by his culture. Fast forward to, you know, him being an adult and everything else, he had a work ethic that, like, he would grind it out. He would just show up, he'd work long hours, he hardly ever complained about anything. You know, I don't know if you know about UPS drivers, but they have to lift those packages in and out of the truck, and they're constantly delivering in rain, sleet, snow, whatever. I remember, like, I wouldn't see my dad for, you know, basically November through February because busy. Not only that, my mom and dad were divorced. That definitely shaped some of my perspective of life. When he came back around, and then I was a part of his life, seeing his work ethic. And then he was a UPS driver during the day. And then at night, he was a property manager. And on the weekends, then he was still working. So, like, I mean, you want to talk about grinding it out and, like, focus. That work ethic that I have, like, I see that. I've leveraged that, you know, when it comes to, like, grinding things out and working things out, I could outpace people if I needed to. I know how to do that, and I've been in that spot. But at the same time, I also know that, like, if you're working by your hands, you're only going to make as much as you're working. And so if you're not working, you're not making money. And for business owners, and to be a successful business, you have to be able to make money without you having to physically touch whatever it is that you're doing or physically grind that out. I've seen what my dad's done. I know how to do that, but I want to get to that next level, and I'm getting to that next level. I'm in that next level where it's like, hey, this is how I leverage your team members to get things done. This is how I'm basically charging the value that I'm creating, not so much the work that's going into it, because I've created processes that create that value. So that's been my drive. And I didn't grow up with any of this. So kind of like the scrappy entrepreneur, just figuring this stuff out and learning and growing. And I constantly read. I've got books on my shelf. I've got a daily routine where I'm learning stuff. And I went back to school later in life, got a degree in economics at the age of 35, which is crazy to do. And the reason why I wanted to study economics, one was my wife has a humanities degree too. And she was like, we both can't have humanities degrees. Somebody has to be able to make money. So I was at a business school and they're like, hey, what about economics? And I was like, cool. It's like social science, but with business applied to it. I got to still get my humanities piece in there. But economics, like, it doesn't get you a job right out of school, but you basically learn the rules of the game and how the system's built and how it runs. And I've always been that person that's always questioning and thinking and trying to figure that out. And so that's the reason why I went that route. And then we were in Eugene. I happened to meet somebody at an event. And she was like, oh, you did economics and you know the stuff and you lived in other cities and then you had this really eclectic background. They're like, you should apply for this job. And so I did. And I interviewed and people were like, we couldn't have recruited from somebody from somewhere, but you were here and you already had this like interesting background. I was able to do that. And I really enjoyed that job.
The job in economic development?
Yeah. If I ever to say my favorite W-2 job ever in my whole entire world was that.
What was that job?
Yeah. So I was the director of economic development. There's kind of some dogged kind of approaches to those things. And so one is like, there's three legs to the stools. There's business recruitment, entrepreneurship, and then there's business retention and expansion. And I had a real heart for business retention expansion because one, 40 to 60% of a region's growth comes from that, like helping existing businesses succeed. And I didn't really care for entrepreneurship because it was like, okay, there's 100 people at a line. A year later, those people, there's like two of them still, right? That's a bummer. And then recruitments, when you do the math on it, you're like, wow, all the incentives, the tax breaks, the like, is this company going to stay? If they stay 1 to 2 years past all the breaks we gave them, we win. But I actually saw locally in that community, the day that the incentives ran out, the company moved. So I didn't really care for recruitment. So I'd like the business retention expansion. And I've had business owners sit across from me crying about their business. They can't pass it on to the next generation. I've had people failing because they're succeeding and things are getting too complex. There's just the business they started that they were really passionate for that was simple grew to such complexity. But at the same time, I did my part. So I actually did help with the recruitment effort. Wayfair was looking for a West Coast location. I hosted them. I had a whole plan and coordinated all the efforts on that, like for the initial visit. And we wound up being selected. This was in Eugene, Oregon.
You alluded earlier to your father and how much he taught you about work ethic just by observing him. And then I also know just from some of your stories, what a voracious reader or listener, if they're podcasts, you are. You mentioned going back to school in your mid-30s. Where do you think your kind of love for learning and voracious appetite for this comes from?
I've always been curious. Even when I was a kid, I took things apart. I didn't know how to put it back together. And at one point, I actually did electrocute myself. So yeah, just wanting to know how things work. There was a point where I kind of realized I'm not going to know everything there is to know. I know it sounds silly, right? Like the nice thing about being youth is that you can think, you know, why can't I fly? And you're like, oh yeah, why can't, you know, that's a good question. But when I realized like, I can't know everything. So the next best thing I can do is talk to people and I can get those experiences. I know you went to Stanford. Like I've never been there. Like I could talk to you and I can get a sense of what it's like. I became fascinated with people. But then you can only talk to so many people at so many times. And so then like books and reading and articles and those kind of things, like that's always available. You know, I'm a little bit older. And so, you know, the internet's been growing since I was in high school. And so having access to like tools and resources have been limited. So books have always been something that you could always get access to. Because I think it's like the blind guy's touching an elephant. You know, what's the elephant look like? And one's going to say like, oh, it feels like a large tree, right? And then another one, like, it feels like a snake. And another one's going to say it feels like, you know, a piece of wood or whatever. And so I think as we all try to explain our version of what we see or what we feel or how we would approach things, I like getting those different perspectives and I like getting those different insights.
How would you describe in a nutshell the value that you look to deliver?
So my ICP, ideal client profile, basically, their business is about $500,000 in revenue to about $5 million in revenue. The analogy that I like to use is if the business was a school bus, the school bus is on fire and the wheels are coming off. The CEO is like, help, help, help. Because the complexity grew over time, it wasn't something like today it was this and tomorrow it's that. It was just something that's been accumulating over time. And so what I like to do is jump in, help the CEO figure out how to get their stuff structured and organized, get those fires put out, so deal with emergencies, get those wheels on the bus, and then get them back on the road and get them on a trajectory to grow and on the right path. Best way to do that is just clarify everything that's happening. So clear documentation, clear org charts, clear job descriptions, checklists. And the fast way for me to do that is to do visual process mapping, where we actually will like take a process and do all of the steps, who's doing what, define everything. And then those process maps, I actually had an IP lawyer tell me one time, she looked at it, she goes, you know, this is actually IP. If you copyright these, now all of a sudden you've got an asset. When you go to sell your business or if you go for a valuation, you can actually increase the value of your business because you now have a documented way of how this process works. I was like, cool. So being a marketer and kind of having that mindset, I was like, great. So I'm going to lead in with process mapping because then I'm creating a valuable asset for obviously for future use. But then also there's something about when you actually talk through a process and can see it, then you can see like, oh, wow, we actually skip steps most of the time. Or all of this work is in my lane. And I really should be handing that off to like an administrative assistant or somebody else. I mean, the nice thing too with those maps then is you can actually take all of that. And if you lay it out step by step, then you put time elements to it. Now you know how long the process takes. If you put in the time times the dollar per hour for each person touching it, you now know what the process costs and what that looks like. And so with a lot of the clients that I work with, they usually hire me because there's an immediate need that they have. We get that fixed and then we go into like the longer term planning part.
Are there any big ahas that you find that business owners have when you kind of finally sit down and process map their work?
So my favorite example is the interior designer. She was basically hitting up against $1 million in revenue and just couldn't get past it. But she was the choke point for everything. Like everything had to go through her. So even though she had a small team, you know, she was the one that was doing the intake and she was the one doing all of the paperwork around it and tracking everything. She had team members that were in higher value positions that were doing higher value work, but she didn't have anybody in the gaps there. And so we did this process mapping and I built a lane for a VA or an EA. And I said, why are you entering things into Basecamp? Or why are you doing all the like task updates and all the notes? And she was like, no, we can't. I can't afford anybody. I was like, you're at $1 million in revenue. I mean, it's interior design and there's some construction costs, but you know, there's still margin in there. And so we started mapping out our processes and I had that lane and I started putting things in there. She started taking things out because she's like, no, I need to do it. And I'm like, just trust me. Somebody else can enter in the customer information in the Basecamp. Like you don't have to. After we did a couple of maps, she started putting things in the lane. So I was like, okay, good. We're making progress. So there was a little bit of an aha moment. And then once we were done, we had about six maps with that EA lane or VA lane, really. And we wrote a job description. And we're like, this is exactly what the person needs to do. And so we found someone, and that person, within a week of starting, the owner had 20 hours of her life back because she didn't have to do all of that little nitty gritty stuff. She had somebody else to do it. Big aha moment for her there was when she hired the person, was like, whoa, this is different. Because in the past, I hired people, I don't know what they're doing. You know, I don't know what they're doing. I don't know what I'm going to have them do. She clearly knew exactly what the person needed to do.
I'm curious, when it comes to process mapping, what kind of gets in the way of people getting going with this work? You alluded to one of those things, just the sense, the irrational belief that nobody can do it as well as I can. Are there other things that get in the way as you're working through that process?
Your audience is going to hate me for this, but yes, it's the people. People get in the way of processes all the time. But we have people that have to do the processes, so we can't get rid of the people. So I'm definitely coming from an operations mindset. So apologies for all the people out there. When you do like science experiments, the challenge of observation, right? When you walk into a situation and then you're like, I'm just here to observe. Everybody's like, wait, what? Oh, okay. Yes, we're going to keep being normal while we're being watched. There's a little bit of bias in there. So even when I map things, I can never get a true shot of what's actually happening because they're already modifying a little bit. Like they'll be doing a process and they're like, oh, this goes to Chuck. And then like, oh, no, it doesn't go to Chuck. It goes to Mary. You know what? It should go to Mary. I think I'm going to tell Mary that she needs to start doing this. And it's like, okay, that's okay. Like, I'll do the best I can to capture the best I can. So I think with that mapping it, being observed, there's a little bit of that kind of bias that people want to perform for that. But the nice thing is usually when I can get two or three versions of that from different people, then I can basically overlay those maps and then show where the gaps are. And then that's the opportunity to have a conversation to say, hey, what really does happen here? And how do you guys resolve this? The other part too is when people think they have it and they're like, oh no, I've got this. Like, I don't even want to talk about it. Okay, well, let's just map it out just for practice sake. And basically like 99% of the time we do that, there's always steps that they skip or things that they're missing. You know, things like when you send an email off to a client, they don't get back to you within the same minute, right? It's like a day or two that they get back to you. So that can cause delays. And so here you think you have this process that gets done in, you know, 3 days, but it actually takes 2 weeks because there's that back and forth between people. And so I like to track those and add those. And then the last thing that it's hard is operations slows things down. So, you know, if you're in high growth mode and you're trying to move super fast, bringing in an operations person and say, hey, let's slow the bus down. Let's like track all the movements. It can be very frustrating, especially for CEOs that are like, hey, I want this done yesterday. It's like, okay, but I still need time to talk to people. I still have to map this out and I still have to figure out a structure for this big challenge.
There's literally just pressure when folks bring someone like you in to like, okay, great, solve this operational issue for me in 2 minutes. Could we do it and go? The very process of operationalizing is a slowing down of the system in order to help it run more efficiently. In some ways, in order to unlock the next level of growth or provide long-term sustainability, you need to sacrifice some short-term acceleration. Which of those two do you find the CEOs balking against, or is it both?
It's both, but not always. I don't know. They're not mutually exclusive, so they can happen at the same time. I mean, I know it sounds weird, but it's like when your car is like stuck in the snow and your tire's spinning. You hit the gas, you're driving too fast for the snow to melt to get the traction that you need to get up and out. You actually need to slow it down, not stop, but slow it down to a place where you allow other things to kind of come around and give you that traction that you need to then up and out. I think one, slowing it down like that would be helpful. The other thing is for CEOs, and I think rightly so, they're at the heartbeat of the business. Like that blood coming in and out of this, there's money, there's time, there's talent, there's all these things. And so the idea that you're like, hey, listen, like heart surgery, right? When they have to repair a valve, they have to figure out how do I operate on something that's live and active and moving and get this piece in there that needs to basically make this work. I think it is almost like heart surgery in some regards where one, you have a sense of death for just that 30 seconds. They have to make the heart stop, right? Like technically you're dead at that point if your heart's not beating. So they do that and then you get in there, you make that repair and then get that thing fired back up. So then you're not dead in the water. Or two, you have to find a way, creative way, like those heart valves that they kind of sneak through, right? And they kind of wire those in and then they pop them open and it makes a spot. I think same thing with operations. You know, we try, and I think that's my job as a consultant is to be mindful of that, not kill the patient, right? While we're operating on them, to get in there, and to implement things and changes in such a way that it'll be like a hiccup, like any other hiccup in the business. But then all of a sudden it'll be performing better because there's that new process or that new thing that we've implemented in. They don't realize the cost is associated with that. Time, energy, stress, all of those components that take to correctly do operations.
Could you speak a little to us about, one, where your love for community comes from, the types of communities you see yourselves as supporting, and what you think your work has to do with that journey?
Again, my dad, coming from like Hispanic background, like family is not just the person that's blood related. It's the like neighbor next door that's over at your house like every other week, or it's the like friends that you make, that you work with, or it's just anyone that's in your circle of life at any extended period of time is family. And so seeing my dad, like he did okay, like as a UPS driver, like he definitely didn't have much. And then he worked really hard, saved and moved himself up. But even though he had a job that was hard and really grueling, he still hung out with people that were salespeople or finance people, or, you know, people that made money in other ways. And he got along with them really well and they liked him. And so some of his even opportunities that he had was because of the connections that he made just through friendships and through having people in his life. Seeing that on a very like micro level, and then I've lived in a few different cities and I've seen some ecosystems where you're like, man, I could see how everyone's kind of working together and kind of helping each other out. We shouldn't have to make rules and regulations about everything, because there should just be a common sense of like, hey, we're doing life together. Like, let's just not be a-holes. Let's help each other out. Like, you know how to cook, I know how to do this. Like, let's just trade and like, let's figure this out. I think that's where ultimately I'm trying to get to. I don't know, build something that, I guess in my own practice, you know, I want to see businesses kind of pass on, and I want to see people have kind of independence, not everybody having to work for somebody else. I want people to have their own dreams, to be able to work towards their own dreams, and owning your own business gives you the ability to do that. But it also comes at the cost of having to understand how business works and understanding how the game is played in as far as politics and rules and regulations and adhering to all of that. I think there is a knowledge gap between people that grow up in a certain, I don't know, background, experience, cultural place, and moving into understanding how to make money. It doesn't have to be you go get a job. You can actually create products and services and build your own business at that same time. And people need help with that. They're part of a community. They're contributing. I think I was saying earlier, like small businesses, they're not the most efficient, right? I mean, if you look at in the grand scheme of things, they don't have economies of scale, but they're there. Like they live in that community. They have to see everybody, you know, whether they buy their products or services or not. And then they hire local talent, they provide local goods and services, and then that money goes right back into that system. And so I'd like to see more of that, because I think if we can get more cash flow into more people's hands, everyone could be abundant. Everyone can live and have a great life, you know, as opposed to all the money being sucked out, going off into somewhere else that then the community doesn't have those resources.
This is something that you actually impacted quite a bit directly as Director of Economic Development back in Eugene, Oregon. I'm curious about what you found was most effective in fostering business growth in that community while you were there. And are there any lessons that could be learned by other communities or other business leaders seeking to foster growth in their own places?
Economic development is kind of like three legs of the stool. And so you have recruitment. Hey, this business wasn't here. Now it's here. Yay. Politicians love it because they get the picture and they get the camera and everything and, you know, whole nine yards. It's also nice for a good infusion into an area. I think that's great. The challenge with that, of course, is when those incentives run out, is that business going to stay and still be there? The second leg of the stool is entrepreneurship. I would love to see more unicorns. I think that's great, but unicorns are rare and it's not the common place. So never really was a big fan of 100 people showing up. And then a year later, you're like, hey, where'd everybody go? And there's one or two people standing around. So not a big fan of that. The third one is business retention and expansion. And that's the idea of helping existing businesses stay and grow. And according to the Economic Development Council, about 40 to 60% of a region's growth comes from existing businesses. So imagine if we could actually support local business enough that each of those businesses could hire one more person. That's a lot of people that are now employed and that not having to rely on, you know, a large corporation for a job. Or one single employer, right, that kind of runs the whole city. It's a way to kind of like diversify our jobs and opportunities. If we can do that, I don't know. It's more people that are engaging in our economic system that have more capacity to participate and engage are resourced. And I don't know. I just feels like that's the right way to go. So with local businesses, we can tighten them up, get them better handle on handling their business, doing that side of it. Yeah, I don't want to sound like a schmo here too bad, but I've seen a lot of people succeed in business because they're really good at what they do and they've had the right people at the right time. But then they kind of get to a place where the lack of business knowledge and insight and understanding kind of that next phase and that next step really holds them back. It's not that they're not able to learn this or know it. It's just that their business is so complex and there's so much focus on running the business. They can't get that next phase. And so I just would like to help people get over that speed bump.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about business resilience for a moment. Depending on what industry you're in, your kind of flavor of this will look slightly different, but it has been a season of economic shock after economic shock in different ways for the last couple of years. Particularly many of the startups, which is my world, have experienced this acutely. While economic shocks are tough on everyone, small businesses are particularly vulnerable. I'm curious whether this is something that comes up when you're working with your clients, thinking about long-term resilience against external economic shocks. And if so, what are some of the things you work with businesses to do to build that resilience?
So the reality is, right, we in aggregate, it all kind of works out, right? But we don't live in the aggregate, right? Like in some sense, there's the winners and losers in some of these things that happen. And so I'm in Tulsa, Oklahoma right now, and we have had a lot of people that were remote workers working for a lot of technology companies. And so when they just did those big rounds of layoffs, like there's a few hundred people in the area now that don't have jobs. So to tell them like, don't worry, on average, you're going to come out okay. They're like, that's great, but I have to live for today.
Yeah.
I think for small businesses, it's the same thing. You know, a couple of thoughts. One, local politics and local economy has more of an impact on small businesses than the national kind of piece.
Mm.
I mean, unless you're connected to government contracts or government, if there's a short line between you and the government, then yes, you're going to feel those repercussions more fiercely and very quickly. But the further away you are, I think there's some padding or there's some, you know, like the shock absorbing, the rest of the economy is kind of picking that up. For small business owners, I mean, that's other part of the passion that I have too, with teaching people how to like manage their business better or document things, get it strengthened. Because then when there is a shock that comes across, if it hits their industry, the people that are going to fold first are the people that don't have those solid foundations and don't have that structure to take that hit. Where if you have things structured and organized in such a way that you know how your business runs, great, this one pipeline of our market just faltered, but we know how to sell our products and services. So let's go find other channels to market to or other groups. Great, now you can do that. And so very directly related to one of my clients, she's in Greenwich, Connecticut, interior designer, does really nice high-end, like high design projects. Her clientele are all financial people. When things are going good in the financial markets, everybody's like, cool, like she's super busy and great. And then when it was like 2008 or, you know, these other like shocks in the financial system, all of a sudden she's like, oh, everybody's on hold or nobody's calling. I'm like, well, maybe we should look at diversifying to, you know, other types of people that you haven't traditionally worked with, but also maybe share a similar ICP, maybe looking at like doctors, lawyers, kind of high net worth individuals or high income earners that also need her services, but don't suffer that same fluctuation. I mean, they do because they're obviously invested in the financial market, but a doctor or a lawyer that's like fully functioning and has a client base that's not dependent on that, they're going to have more resiliency and they're not going to ebb and flow as heavily. So trying to get people aware of like, okay, that's great. From a risk analysis side, right? Like, oh, you only have one source that you're getting all of this? Oh, let's diversify just a little bit here. Let's add that more lens to this.
One of the things that you assert pretty clearly is that exit planning is kind of essential for all business owners, regardless of when they're thinking that exit is going to happen. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about why you believe that, what good exit planning looks like.
So why it matters? Well, because life is uncertain. You can't plan for every disaster, but you have to know that there are shocks and surprises that they just happen. If you have it in place, then you're going to have to be very mindful of building your business in such a way that you can exit. Because I think when you first start your business, you're just trying to get product sale. You're trying to figure out viability, everything else. Your business starts running, starts making money. Things are good. But then you get to a place where you're like, man, I'm doing everything. And it winds up being like a for some people, a terrible job. You know, if you actually look at the total hours that they work plus their distribution and then the profit that they get, all of a sudden, I did a calculation for one client, $7 an hour. Like over $500,000 a year, and they're getting $7 an hour. It's like, you know, you could go flip burgers and make more money. They're like, oh, damn, like that sucks. But if you can build a business in a way that someone else can run that, then you can keep moving yourself into higher value work, charging appropriately, then it allows you to get to a place where you're actually a business owner and the business can run without you having to be there for everything or be the choke point for it. And I think it's important because shocks happen. And a big one that really came to me as I talked to business brokers was divorce. Like I asked, what's the number one reason why you guys get valuations? Like, oh, because people are going through a divorce. You know, oh, aha moment for myself, because people forget that it's a business. So the value is not just the money that you're getting in. It's not a paycheck. It's business. So even though you're getting a small bit of this business, it still has value. And that's the thing that people forget, is that all of the stuff you're doing is actually building this machine that has value in of itself. You can't see it as a job. You have to see it as this machine. And so again, if you're potentially going through a divorce, that partner that you've had for all this time, they help contribute to some of the building that machine. And so they get to get some of that value. All of a sudden you're like, okay, so I'm making $7 an hour and I've got a $500,000 business that valuating, let's say at 3 million, because you get a 6x multiplier because everything's documented correctly. Great. Now your partner wants 1.5 million to draw off of the business. That's not there. Like it's just, you can't do it if you're the one that's doing all the work. So I think being prepared for that. Also, when I was in Eugene, Oregon, they had one of the worst snowstorms ever. And all of a sudden, bridges were closed, supplies weren't coming in, people weren't shopping. And so, you know, what's supposed to be a short shock has a lasting impact to people, because all of a sudden their margins are super thin. So they didn't get a couple of days worth of sales, and the inventory is still being sent from wherever. And, you know, all of a sudden they've got this weird glitch where they've got this big problem now that's compounded by everything else. And so if you don't have a plan in place, or if you don't know your structure or how to organize those things, it can definitely cause you a lot of pain. I also fundamentally believe that even though it's business, there's still people behind it. And so people have an expiration date. We're not here forever. So especially with small businesses, so you need to know when that transition point is going to happen, you know, and that could be, like for us, we're empty nesters. And so, you know, our kids in the next couple of years, potentially we could be grandparents. Like, oh, it'd be nice to go live there with them, right? So if I owned a local pizza shop or something, it would be nice to be able to transition that to somebody else. Get some of that value back that I put into the business, and then go live near them. Now, even with PE firms acquiring a lot of service-based businesses, sometimes you get someone knocking on your door and they're like, hey, by the way, here's a check for $1 million. We'd love your business. And you're like, oh, wow, cool. I'm only at $500,000 a year, you know, revenue, and I'm making $7 an hour because I'm working 80 hours a week. I'll take the $1 million. But what you don't know is that you were sitting on a $3 million business because you were the only person in the market. And if you just would have done a little more work, you could have actually got more value out of that.
What excites you most, Joshua?
I think empowering more people to be business owners, moving from solopreneur to business owner. I don't know. It's been a tough journey for myself personally as a consultant and trying to build my own business. And I actually have two businesses, but trying to build those up and get those running and like get those to where they're doing well, I've enjoyed that very much. And so I think there's other people that could also enjoy that, knowing that that's an option for their life to pursue that path. I think the financial independence that comes as you succeed, I think that's a great reward. And I think we should set more people up for this, that they are able to do this. And so that's what I'm passionate about. And that's part of the reason why I do work as a fractional COO, because I get to hop in somebody else's car, learn how they drive it, learn what they're doing, at the same time, contribute my strengths and insights, help them build and do that in a way that's mutually beneficial for both of us. I really enjoy that.
Is there anything that you think would be important for our audience to know that I didn't ask the right question for you to get across?
As you're doing your business, like, remembered why you got into this. I think for service-based businesses, they worked for somebody else usually, and they're like, oh, this guy's terrible, or this person's terrible. Like, I can do this better. And so they go and they get some initial success, and they do well. And then you get to a place where it's like that dark season of the soul, where you have to like, why did I do this? And like, what's going on? And the world's against me. And it's like, just keep going through the forest. Like, you'll get to the other side. Like, just keep pressing forward and don't forget why you did this. Cause I think there is a tendency to look at that playbook that of the place that you last left and be like, well, that's how they did it. So, and they're successful. You left that. So why would you want that playbook? I have found personally in my consulting that most people usually know what to do. There's that intuition that they have. They just need confirmation on that, or they need support to help execute it. I very rarely find an entrepreneur that's like, man, I got all the success. I got all the way here, but I have no clue what to do next. Mm-hmm. I have no idea about new products, and I have no idea how to service the next mm-hmm. batch. Like mm-hmm. that doesn't happen. That brain is always working. And so to tap into that ever creating cycle and keep going,